listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. We nominate for Oblivion Nepo Baby. The Internet's favorite insult used to mean something, argues Hilary Bussis, before imprecision and overuse dulled its impact. Illustrator Patrick Svensson gives us a picture of a silver spoon, and it's tarnished. Few flavors of pedant are as irritating as the syntax scold, those humorless hall monitors who smirk as they tell total strangers what nonplussed actually means. So everyone confuses literal with figurative. Literally, who cares? It gives me no pleasure to join their ranks, but I can no longer stay silent, because as a culture, we've totally lost the plot on what a Nepo baby is. The term has been inescapable since 2022, when 25-year-old Canadian at Miriam Is Tired tweeted how shocked she was to learn that Euphoria star Maude Apatow is a nepotism baby because her mother is Leslie Mann while her father is a movie director, LOL. To Gen Z readers, the most astonishing part of that message wasn't that at Miriam Is Tired had never heard of Judd Apatow. It was the reveal of a vast left coast conspiracy. The self-made Sydney Sweeneys and Zendayas suddenly seemed to be dwarfed by the Mauds, famous people who got a leg up because, gasp, their parents were also famous. Forget that this truism is almost as old as time. Did you know Isaac was actually the son of Abraham? Forget that it's foundational to the film industry in particular, which has a long tradition of incubating familial talent. The Barrymores, the Houstons, the Fondas, the Kardashians. Before Nepo Baby, we called them Hollywood royalty. The neologism caught on because it was a snappy way to summarize an ancient form of injustice at a time when calling out injustice felt like an important thing to do. The problem is that careless usage has gradually shifted the Nep Overton window, expanding the term until it's lost both its meaning and its bite. Because to paraphrase an old line about champagne and sparkling wine, it's only nepotism if you're doing the same job your parents did. Otherwise, it's just called being rich. Take, as the New York Post so often does, the case of Zohran Mamdani. The Democratic Socialist and recently elected mayor is the first to admit he grew up privileged, the son of Columbia professor Mahmoud Mamdani and celebrated filmmaker Mira Nair. He is not, however, a Nepo baby, at least not in his capacity as a politician. Though he certainly was one when he worked as third assistant director on Nair's 2016 film, Queen of Katwe. You know, nepotism and hard work goes a long way, Mamdani joked in an interview with a South African radio station that year. In some dynasties, the lineage is clear. The Trumps and the Kennedys are a long line of nesting Nepo babies. In others, the label simply isn't always correct. George W. Bush is unquestionably a Nepo baby. Jenna Bush Hager is not, because she didn't get famous for starting a war on Iraq. Maya Hawke, who got her breakout film role from her Uncle Quentin, obvious Nepo baby. Lena Dunham doesn't count unless you really think conceptual artists hold undue sway over HBO's executive suite. In fact, despite what critics in the 20-teens would have had you think, arguably none of the girls on Girls were true blue Nepo babies. Allison Williams didn't go into newscasting. Zosha Mamet acts in plays but doesn't write them. Jemima Kirk's parents are a drummer and a boutique owner. Yes, she's a childhood friend of Dunham's, but if you get a job because of who you're friends with, rather than who your parents are, that isn't nepotism either. It's cronyism. Words have meaning. We live in a society. As a slang term, nepo baby is played out. Asking actual nepo babies about what it's like to be a nepo baby has also become its own shop-worn trope. But ultimately, the phrase deserves to be retired because, like woke and hipster before it, it's a once-specific coinage that's become a catch-all epithet. There are plenty of legitimate reasons to hate wealthy people who have the audacity to keep achieving. There's no need to invent new ones. Go ahead, eat the rich, but at least describe them accurately first. Oh, tech bros, where art thou? As the technology brothers, John Coogan and Jordy Hayes have cornered the Silicon Valley media market with their irresistibly insidery podcast. Now, writes Julia Black, they're coming for you. Photographs by Ryan Pfluger. Opening photo, the J-Team. John Coogan and Jordy Hayes take a brief off-mic moment to pose in Los Angeles in September. It was 4 p.m. on a Thursday, and the Technology Brothers had a gong problem. John Coogan and Jordy Hayes had just wrapped a taping of their daily cult favorite podcast, TBPN, short for Technology Business Programming Network, when they realized their 36-inch gong, which they ring to commemorate the fundraising triumphs of their startup world guest, was no longer cutting it. They had already blown through two smaller models. Now the towering ceiling of their new Hollywood soundstage was making even the 36-inch set piece feel diminutive. The Hadrian gong would be a great sponsorship, Coogan mused. He was referring to the defense tech manufacturer that had announced a $260 million Series C on the show that afternoon. Alas, Hadrian had already run the numbers. TBPN's dream gong wouldn't fit in the machines the company uses to fabricate rocket parts. Fortunately, their producer, Ben Kohler, had tracked down an 80-inch beauty in Memphis. Coogan leaned in to see his laptop. $40,000? Coogan said, sounding less appalled than giddy at the figure. While they have yet to commit to the bigger gong, they have since invested in a life-size bronze horse, modeled after Napoleon's war horse, Marengo. In the world of the Technology Brothers, a willingness to spend in service of the bit has become the bit itself. They drive expensive cars, they wear luxury watches, and they react to tech and finance news in an unapologetically celebratory manner. Let's give it up for private equity. Let's give it up for the vice presidents, they'll say over a slow clap. Let's give it up for VCs. The year-old show, at first called the Technology Brothers Podcast, is part CNBC Squawk Box, part Joe Rogan, part Daily Show. It's available on YouTube, Spotify, and other podcasting platforms, but its spiritual home is X. We turned the X timeline into an audiovisual show where we provide insider commentary and analysis, says Hayes. In March, the show was rebranded to its new name, TBPN. They refined their brand kit, mahogany, the official wood of business, shades of green, the color of money, racing livery jackets and hats, and a hint of sci-fi. They also moved into a barrel-vaulted studio in the heart of L.A. with a meticulously curated back office. Glass cases of neatly stacked merch sit next to a library of leather-bound great books of the Western world. Beneath the huge American flag and black-and-white portraits of iconic investors like Peter Lynch and Charlie Munger. As the show climbs the charts, an appearance on TBPN has become a status marker for the tech elite. Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Andreessen, and Sam Altman stop by to gab. When OpenAI released its hotly anticipated GPT-5 model in August, executives from the company offered up the kind of exclusive interviews tech journalists have spent years begging for. I should know. I'm one of them. Yet their biggest guests are sometimes the most niche, like Soham Parekh, an Indian software engineer who became X's main character for a day after he was caught working for multiple startups at the same time. Their guests are capitalizing on the cloud economy, where the line between influencer and entrepreneur is blurred and attention is the most valuable asset. The mix of A-listers and memes captures something essential about TBPN's appeal. Through their approachable lens, fans can access a parasocial relationship with the tech elite. I joined the brothers, not actual siblings, but a friendship match made in free market heaven for one of their three-hour-plus recordings this summer. The guys live stream from a desk littered with cans of VC-backed beverage brands and tins of XL pouches produced by Coogan's 9-year-old nicotine company, Lucy. Racks of bespoke Jay Muser suits await them backstage. Half a dozen college-age interns mill around in TBPN-branded merch, modeled to look like Formula One gear, handling tens of thousands of dollars of video equipment with surprising expertise. Coogan and Hayes follow a well-worn rule in the world of venture-backed startups: scale at all cost. They believe their always-on mentality will ultimately set them apart from their part-time competitors. Every other show in tech, says Hayes, was a guest sitting down and interviewing for an hour, and they usually were done by people that were not full-time, that had other priorities other than the show. I run a marathon every day, Coogan tells me, in just one of many instances when the co-host compare their daily live stream to elite athletic training. So it's like, of course, I'm going to win. At 36 and 29, Coogan and Hayes are already serial founders. In 2013, Coogan co-founded the buzzy nutrient sludge for workaholics company Soylent. A few years later, he co-founded the nicotine pouch and gum company Lucy, which helped him get a gig as entrepreneur-in-residence at Peter Thiel's venture firm Founders Fund. Hayes, meanwhile, founded the YouTube advertising company Branded Native, and then co-founded a fintech company, Party Round, now called Capital, with his wife, Sarah Chase Hayes. Coogan and Hayes met in 2023 through their mutual friend, the extremely online healthcare startup founder Will Manidis, and quickly bonded over their unadulterated love of capitalism. They soon began firing off business ideas, including an energy drink purpose-built for white-collar workers, said Hayes. Horrified by visions of a future spent shaking hands with regional directors at Las Vegas beverage industry trade shows, they kept brainstorming. Hayes had experience in advertising, while Coogan had gotten into content creation during the pandemic. But while Coogan racked up millions of views for his YouTube explainers about political figures like Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, he was frustrated by the hours of prep work that went into producing a single episode. What if they could bottle the energy of a Silicon Valley insider group chat? They liked being able to bounce ideas off each other without things getting too crowded. Plus, they could juice their networks for a call-in show dynamic, even booking big-name guests over DM while live on camera. In an early video for YouTube, they printed out a post by a popular anonymous X account at NetCapGirl and analyzed it on camera. She couldn't resist retweeting their video, getting them free exposure to 100,000 new viewers. On to the next viral account, rinse, repeat. Our first growth hack, Coogan tells me. Hayes came up with the original name of the show, Technology Brothers, in an effort to reclaim the term after tech bro had become a slur. They also began to develop caricature versions of themselves, two Gordon Geckos for the venture capital era. From there, Coogan says, we had a crazy flow state. Beyond the gong, other bits of prop comedy give them cover to dive into more controversial topics. Coogan dons a medieval helmet to steel man unpopular arguments and a tinfoil hat to go full conspiracy theorist. They're following Coogan's law, always be coining. Hayes is known for his impeccable hair and attention to aesthetics. Coogan, at 6'8", has a certain Cousin Greg appeal. If Cousin Greg could actually be trusted with managing Waystar Royco's cruise division. Coogan's height has created another size problem. Hayes, not exactly diminutive at 6'1", tends to look miniature in comparison to his co-host. Fans sometimes confuse them for actual brothers, but they insist they're quite different. I like European cars. Most of the cars I've owned are Mercedes, says Hayes. John is very, very American, so he drives a Cadillac. Same goes for health. John's a junkyard dog, so he'll have anything, says Hayes. Coogan counters, a single inorganic blueberry would kill Jordy on the spot. On TBPN, the conflict of interest is a feature, not a bug. Both hosts are independently wealthy from multi-million-dollar exits and angel investing. They know what it's like to raise a seed round, close an exit, weigh a tender offer. They're on a texting basis with half of Silicon Valley. They casually name-drop Christmas parties at Teal's. In an era when AI researchers are being poached in 10-figure deals that make NBA free agent negotiations look like child's play, Coogan and Hayes cover the AI talent wars like ESPN analysts. They count on the fact that their audience can keep up with the inside baseball. A lot of other shows would say Amazon Web Services, Amazon's cloud computing business, explains Coogan. We just say AWS. Next photo, Thunderdome. Hayes and Coogan are fond of props, wordplay, and their signature gong, a symbol of technological triumph. Coogan and Hayes started their show in part as a way to combat the negativity of traditional tech journalists. Sometimes they'll have good intentions, but they'll miss the true story, says Hayes. They argued that they are providing commentary and analysis and a layer over the true journalism that is actually very healthy. My own introduction to the brothers happened last year when they devoted a 40-minute segment to picking apart a story I wrote for the tech publication, The Information, about Christianity and tech, which cast a somewhat critical eye on some of their friends in the Tealverse. She doesn't have the literary chops and expertise to write something truly groundbreaking, said Hayes about me at the time. He called to make nice after the episode came out. It's like WWE informed me of our new public rivalry. I could either choose to be offended, or I could embrace the growth hack. The traffic they helped direct to my piece made it one of my best performing that year. TBPN can also provide a soft landing for friends in the tech industry navigating an unfolding scandal. In July, after rampant flooding claimed more than 130 lives in the Texas Hill Country, false rumors started to spread on social media that Coogan and Hayes' friend Augustus Storico had contributed to the bad weather with his cloud seeding company Rainmaker. Storico took to X to call the accusations baseless. Shortly after, Sean McGuire, a partner at Sequoia, inflamed the Internet by posting about the then-New York City mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani. He comes from a culture that lies about everything. It's literally a virtue to lie if it advances his Islamist agenda. The brothers hosted Storico and dedicated multiple segments to McGuire's drama. In 2024, Lulu Cheng Miservi, a successful bulldog PR rep for many conservative companies, wrote an essay titled Go Direct, The Manifesto. She warned founders against yielding control over their narratives to media and suggested instead using social media to develop their own voices. A friend of the pod, Miservi consulted TBPN on their launch strategy. TBPN joins a group of right-leaning techno-optimist outlets, creating a circular media ecosystem by, for, about, and funded by Silicon Valley. Print publications like Arena and Colossus, publishing hagiographic profiles of founders and investors, and online outlets like Pirate Wires and the Paramount-owned The Free Press that take a strong libertarian stance. Every firm on Sand Hill Road has its own podcast. In July, Andreessen Horowitz hired one of TBPN's former employees to join its new media team. Last summer, Palantir Chief Technology Officer Shyam Sankar, early Palantir employee Ryan Podolsky, and investor Christian Garrett announced they were launching Founders Films, a production company devoted to celebrating American exceptionalism. As for the technorati takeover of Washington, D.C., Coogan and Hayes see no issue. Following a November New York Times story critiquing investor David Sachs's potential conflicts of interest in his role as President Donald Trump's AI and crypto czar, Hayes weighed in, unless you're just blanket against these industries, it's hard to argue that you want somebody for that type of role that doesn't have any expertise in said industries. Part of the brothers' shtick is their tireless commitment to the products they are paid to shill. Unlike most podcasts, the TBPN hosts insert deadpan ads for Ramp, upscale Airbnb competitor Wander, and luxury watch marketplace Bezel seamlessly into their flow of conversation. I lost count of the number of times they pivoted our conversation to ask if I'd considered switching to the business accounting software Ramp. What these companies all have in common is they target a small tech elite. When your social circle has a combined net worth bigger than the GDP of most small countries, your total addressable market only needs to stretch so far. Still, TBPN brings a degree more objectivity than in-house editorial. If one venture fund creates a media product, it's default boring, says Hayes. You're going to naturally create content to lift up your portfolio alone. TBPN, he says, aims to be the Switzerland of technology, often hosting competitor companies and funds on the same episode. This fall, after an historic bull run, markets started to wobble, in part due to fears of an AI bubble. At the same time, the hosts began to process feedback that they appeared to be blindly pro-tech. The normie write-up on TBPN so far has been like it's Sports Center for tech, and they just love tech, and they just sit here all the time like tech good, Hayes said in a November interview, pretending to clap like a seal. They say they're not afraid to question overinflated evaluations or unrealistic revenue projections. We're in a position where we feel responsible to call out the big players, even the players that come on our show, says Hayes. They have also begun to weigh in more often on the negative externalities of technological progress, like chatbot-induced psychosis, AI labor displacement, and the industry's over-eagerness to lean into adult content and gambling. Finding that line of technology is good, but we can still have real concerns around humanity is the goal, says Hayes. We both have, between us, 5 kids under 5. We care not just about what data center development looks like in the next 12 months. We actually care about what data center development looks like in the next 12 years, Coogan interrupts, unable to resist a punchline. No, like what is education going to look like in 12 years, says the more serious Hayes. I wondered aloud how long they would realistically ride out the show before getting bored. Coogan stopped me, dead serious, from the back seat of a Maybach an intern was chauffeuring us around in. I would be shocked if the show isn't 90% of our income or net worth in a few years. For the last few years, All In has been the rising star of the tech media universe. Four entrepreneurs and venture capitalists in their 40s and 50s, offer commentary on the day's tech news, markets, and, increasingly, politics. But as the middle-aged podcasters grew whinier, less self-aware, and more consumed by the kind of culture war bugaboos you'd expect to see from your great-aunt on Facebook, a gap opened up in the market. Combined with the powerful divorced dad energy emanating from Elon Musk, and the cringy midlife crisis makeovers of Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos, it started to look like getting filthy rich off technology was, well, not a very cool thing to do. Coogan and Hayes never watch playback of their own show. For them, the only metric of success is asking themselves, how do you feel at the end of that 3 hours, says Coogan. Do you feel happy? Were you laughing? For now, the answer is consistently yes. Youthful, well-dressed, and charismatic, TBPN is making Silicon Valley wealth look fun again. They know they're no saints. One of them runs an addictive nicotine company, but they have drawn certain lines in the sand. They don't swear on air, they try to avoid vulgarity, and they don't promote alcohol or drug use, mostly because they're not big drinkers themselves. Perhaps most importantly, this show is never going to promote Burning Man, Hayes deadpans. On July 31st, the brothers reported live from a booth at the New York Stock Exchange for the IPO of the design software company Figma, co-founded by their friend Dylan Field. Throughout the day, they hosted a revolving door of people whose personal net worths had just ticked up 7+ figures. "We had them holding their own microphones and ringing the gong like kids," Coogan told me later, laughing. The president of the NYSE group, Lynn Martin, stopped by off the air, according to Coogan, to tell them she was a big fan and that she hoped they would be back soon. In December, NYSE announced that it would become TBPN's exclusive exchange partner, giving the podcasters direct access to future IPOs and an ongoing presence on the floor, not unlike CNBC's. The night of the Figma IPO, the brothers co-hosted a party with newsletter writer Emily Sundberg at the exclusive San Vicente bungalows in the Jane Hotel. In a room buzzing with the spirit of business, CNBC host and New York Times columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin, social platforms producer Adam Faes, and Oddlots co-host Joe Wiesenthal snacked on Wagyu pigs in blankets and caviar-topped hash browns. For now, they've attracted a relatively small audience with a huge concentration of capital. "You can just count the billionaires that follow the show," says Hayes. "Sometimes fans like Joshua Kushner, Travis Kalanick, and Larry Ellison are more valuable as viewers than guests." He adds, "We care about people that are in the game, making investment decisions, building companies." Their trip to New York, where their first billboard advertising campaign launched last summer, is part of an effort to expand TBPN's audience. After all, even normies could benefit from a peek inside the billionaire group chat. Last summer, the brothers hosted the 24-year-old AI commentator Dwarkesh Patel for a half-hour segment. He had just released an essay detailing his revised projections for the arrival of artificial general intelligence. "It was narrative-setting and venture, and it should have moved the markets," says Coogan. "If you're a Citigroup analyst on NVIDIA stock, that should be huge. That's the next market TBPN is hoping to capture. If in 20 years you told me, 'John, you're going to be as big as Andrew Ross Sorkin,' I would be like, 'That's perfect.' The respect is mutual. I admire the entrepreneurial spirit behind what John and Jordy are doing with TBPN. They built something real, super fast, and earned the trust of a sharp, influential audience. It's exciting to watch the next generation reinvent how we talk about tech and business," Sorkin tells me. The brothers say they've taken meetings with most of the major TV networks at this point, but have no plans to sell. They've seen other independent podcasters do so and lose their magic. "I can't imagine any acquisition scenario that doesn't make the content worse," says Hayes, "and we want to do this indefinitely." Meanwhile, they've got traditional tech media running scared. They estimated there have been 7 different attempts by other media companies or podcasters to reverse engineer their show. None have taken off. While prepping for the show during my visit, Hayes reads aloud from X, "Never interrupt your opponent while he is in the middle of making a mistake," he says with a smirk. "I can repost that, right?" The day I visited Coogan and Hayes in L.A., a tech CEO was going viral after he was caught on camera at a Coldplay show snuggling up with one of his executives, who was notably not his wife. You couldn't have scripted a better piece of TBPN fodder. While in line for coffee that morning, Hayes dashed off an X post, "Startup CEOs can't even hug their chief people officer at a concert in this country anymore." As he watched the likes pour in, he predicted they would top 10,000 or so. When I checked it the next morning, there were over 70,000. For the better part of a decade, I have sat in newsrooms and marketing brainstorms as media folk have tried to conjure the kind of virality that Hayes produced in approximately 12 seconds. Back in the studio, Coldplay's Fix You plays on the studio sound system as the brothers settle in for another hours-long live stream. Coogan stretches his massive wingspan and sways to the music as the on-air countdown ticks toward zero. It's really simple. We're either journalists or analysts or comedians or something else, and we'll figure it out over the next 5 years, he shouts over to me. But we're not going anywhere. The Autopsy Report, in an exclusive excerpt from his new book, Bonfire of the Murdochs, Gabriel Sherman dissects the collapse of a media dynasty. Opening photo, Ties That Unbind. Lachlan, James, Elizabeth, and Rupert Murdoch in the 1980s. For 70 years, Rupert Murdoch hid from confrontation. He fired his mentor by letter, divorced a wife by email, and used one child to fire another. But in a sterile Nevada courtroom in September 2024, the 93-year-old mogul's money and power couldn't protect him any longer. He would finally face his estranged children under oath. In early December 2023, Rupert unilaterally altered the irrevocable family trust to install his son Lachlan as his successor. Murdoch's other adult children from his first two marriages, Prudence, Elizabeth, and James, sued to block the change. The lawsuit set up the final courtroom battle and a long-waged war to decide once and for all who would control his empire following his death. Discovery had been like an autopsy of a family's slow death. Depositions became an arena of psychological abuse. In one, Rupert's lawyer fired humiliating questions at James as Rupert looked on. "Have you ever done anything successful on your own? Why were you too busy to say happy birthday to your father when he turned 90? Does it strike you that in your account, everything that goes wrong is always somebody else's fault?" At one point, James noticed Rupert tapping on his phone and realized he was scripting the questions for the lawyer to ask. "How effing twisted is that?" James later recalled. For years, James had defended his father in public. At the Vanity Fair Oscar party in 2018, he confronted a journalist who had written critically about the company. "You're just trying to make a buck off my old man," he said, as his wife, Catherine, gently tapped his arm to calm him down. James could defend Rupert no longer. Rupert crafted narratives in the shadows, but the courtroom would require him to do it in the open. He needed to prove that his decision to give his empire to Lachlan wasn't about politics, misogyny, or primogeniture. It was about money. Preserving Fox News's conservative voice was best for the business. The Nevada probate commissioner would allow Rupert to amend the trust if he acted in good faith to protect his children's financial interest. But James, Liz, and Prue, referred to in Rupert's court filings as the objecting children, had a crucial advantage. They simply needed to keep the status quo. Their lawyers prepared to argue that Rupert and Lachlan were disenfranchising them to further Rupert's dynastic and political project. If Rupert and Lachlan wanted them out of the trust, then they should pay a fair price for their shares. Anything else was stealing. Facing the fight of his life, Rupert reached for his most reliable weapon, emotional manipulation. When Prue's birthday arrived weeks before the trial, flowers appeared at her door. More brazenly, Rupert sent documents to James's lawyer with a handwritten note. "Dear James, still time to talk? Love, Dad. P.S. Love to see my grandchildren one day." The message was vintage Rupert. Personal appeal wrapped around a business proposition with a dash of guilt. None of the siblings took the bait. They had learned too much about their dad's methods to fall for his final charm offensive. On the cold and gusty morning of September 17th, Rupert arrived at the courthouse in a navy sweater under his dark suit, which he punctuated with a bright yellow tie. Photographs captured his wrinkled face, etched by deep grooves like a complex irrigation system. He climbed the courthouse steps with a pronounced stoop. It was the image of a man under siege. Rupert's lawyer, Adam Streisand, had a difficult task ahead. The trial's opening day had not gone well for Rupert and Lachlan. Putting Rupert on the stand was a risk. He had a habit of stepping in it, especially when questioned. Years ago, Rupert's PR advisor blanched when Rupert blurted out during an interview that Muslims have an inbreeding problem because they marry their cousins. Streisand was one of the country's preeminent trust lawyers and well-positioned to shepherd Rupert through the most important testimony of his life. He previously litigated a lawsuit over the estate of William Randolph Hearst. At first, Rupert stuck to the script. "I just felt sure. very certain that if these things weren't settled, there would be trouble, Rupert said, his voice faint but lucid. If there's uncertainty about the management, the public will feel it. Inside, the company would feel it. There was logic to his argument, but James had recruited a legal heavy hitter of his own to dismantle it. Gary Bornstein, the co-head of litigation at Kravath, Swain & Moore. Under Bornstein's deft cross-examination, Rupert admitted that he changed the trust to protect his conservative legacy as much as the business. It would be a disaster for America if James convinced his sisters to depose Lackland, Rupert said. Bornstein had Rupert cornered. The solution to that problem of having Liz and Prue having to make a decision was for you to make the decision for them, correct? He asked. Yes, Rupert replied. In that single word, he put his self-serving misogyny on full view. When the session ended, Rupert left the courthouse and didn't return for the remainder of the trial. He told the judge he was sick, but James thought otherwise. It was cowardice, he later said. After each day in court, James, Prue, and Liz retired with their spouses to a friend's house in Lake Tahoe, about an hour away. They drank wine and reenacted memorable exchanges from the trial. But it was more than just debriefing. It was reconciliation. James and Liz were finally burying years of estrangement engineered by their father's manipulation during the phone hacking scandal. Even Liz and Prue, half-sisters, whose relationship had been punctuated by epic screaming fights, found common ground. The mood was cautiously optimistic, though the stakes were too high to truly relax. The trial's third day belonged to the objecting children. This was the moment they had waited for their entire lives, the chance to tell their truth under oath, and to have a judge rule their father had wronged them. They told a story of hurt and betrayal. Liz testified how unbelievably close she had been with her father, but now the relationship was absent. James broke down crying when he talked about his mistreatment by his father and brother. There have been a lot of hurtful things over the years, he said. We worked together very closely for a long time. It's hard. As Lachlan stared back, James thought to himself, how had it come to this? The siblings' emotions calcified during Streisand's pointed cross-examination. Streisand's questions were designed to reinforce the narrative Rupert's legal team had been pushing since depositions. James, Liz, and Prue were white, privileged, multi-billionaire trust fund babies, scheming to advance their left-wing agenda at the cost of destroying their father's companies. Streisand sought to prove this by focusing on a secret meeting the three siblings held in a private room at Claridge's Hotel on September 20, 2023. In Streisand's telling, they had gathered in London to plan how they would fire Lachlan upon Rupert's death. Is it customary for you, when you have drinks with your siblings and dinner, to book a hotel conference room? Streisand asked Liz. Liz admitted it wasn't, but the choice of venue wasn't evidence of a plot. They simply wanted privacy to discuss funeral planning for their father. According to depositions, the meeting had been encouraged by Liz's lawyer, Mark Devereaux, who conceived Project Bridge to prepare for Rupert's death. Devereaux, a self-described succession addict, was deeply troubled when he watched the episode that depicted the fictional mogul Logan Roy's sudden death and the kids' scramble to issue a public statement. Streisand didn't buy it. He challenged James about the Claridge's summit. Do you deny saying anything about suggesting that once you do have your agency, that you do something about getting your brother out? Streisand asked. I do deny that, James said. For much of the afternoon, James contained his trademark aggression. But late in the day, his patience with Streisand's questions expired. It's garbage, he said. They're making stuff up or believing things that are being told to create some sort of boogeyman that is a justification for stealing stuff that they didn't want to buy. Lachlan was the last to testify. The trial had unfolded like a microcosm of his life. He sat silently while others questioned his right to lead. He never asked to be his father's chosen son. It was his birthright, though at low moments it felt like a curse. No matter how much he achieved, critics questioned whether he was fit to stand in his father's shoes. Next photos, not serious people, the Washoe County Courthouse in Reno, Lachlan Murdoch and his wife Sarah with their legal team, Prudence, James and his wife Catherine, Elizabeth, Rupert. The legal battle had crystallized Lachlan's anger at his siblings for never recognizing his business record. His several million-dollar investment in the real estate listing service REA Group was now worth billions. He prudently stayed out of the streaming wars and instead invested modestly in the advertising-supported streamer Tubi. Despite this, his siblings never supported him publicly. In early 2023, Lachlan pleaded with Liz to issue a statement refuting a Financial Times article that said James would force him out upon Rupert's death. "This is terrible, and you have to say something," he told her. Liz declined. The betrayal stung. During James's testimony, when Streisand asked if he had ever supported Lachlan, James's answer was brutal. "I don't believe so." Even Rupert's absence from the courtroom felt like painful déjà vu. Just like the times Rupert had left Lachlan to fend for himself against the courtiers who wanted him gone. It was the Rupert way. His mother, Dame Elizabeth, had thrown Rupert into the water to teach him to swim. "I had to dog paddle to the side, and I was screaming," Rupert once said. Now Lachlan was drowning alone. But it was too late to get out of the pool. On the stand, Lachlan struggled. While his siblings gave hours of testimony about Rupert's psychological abuse, Lachlan was the lonely voice describing an attentive father who took him camping and generously made him and his siblings fantastically rich. "He gave the companies to us," he said. The real betrayal, Lachlan said, was his siblings' refusal to knock down the articles that said a coup was coming. If Liz and Prue and James had come out at any point in this time publicly on the record and said, "This is false. Lachlan does not get fired the day Rupert dies. We are not a gang of three against him," that would have stopped the stories, he testified. "It would have been a very simple, straight thing to do, and it would have been a decent thing, too." It was an emotionally resonant appeal, but a legally ineffective one. Under cross-examination, Lachlan became flustered and evasive, like he was back in the boardroom struggling to debate James. He defended his father's warped philosophy that journalists should feed audiences what they want, even if what they want are lies. The nadir came when Lachlan admitted he had no evidence for his claim that James or his surrogates leaked stories about a coup. The trial had reduced Lachlan to a Fox News host. He was spreading conspiracies, just like the network he controlled. On Saturday, December 7th, 2024, 1 year to the day since Rupert launched the legal battle to amend the trust, Commissioner Edmund Gorman issued his decision. Rupert lost. In a stinging rebuke, Gorman called Rupert's plan a carefully crafted charade to permanently cement Lachlan Murdoch's executive roles, regardless of the impacts such control would have over the companies or the beneficiaries. "This wasn't about business," Gorman said. "It was about a political legacy." Gorman ruled that Rupert wanted his companies to continue to be alternative, conservative voices in the media after he dies. To achieve this goal, Gorman said Rupert had violated the trust rules by trying to strip James, Liz, and Prue of their voting power to remove Lachlan after Rupert's death. Lachlan fared even worse. Gorman criticized his lack of candor on the witness stand. It was an humiliating coda. Gorman's decision was a resounding victory for James, Liz, and Prue. They prevented Rupert from stripping them of their rights to determine the empire's future upon Rupert's death. In 2030, the trust expires, and the siblings are free to sell their shares to the highest bidder. The effort was an attempt to stack the deck in Lachlan Murdoch's favor after Rupert Murdoch's passing so that his succession would be immutable, Gorman wrote. The play might have worked, but an evidentiary hearing, like a showdown in a game of poker, is where gamesmanship collides with the facts, and at its conclusion, all the bluffs are called and the cards lie face up. Even Rupert's effort to keep the most intimate details of his family's implosion secret failed. Someone leaked 3,000 pages of court records to the New York Times. In February 2025, the paper published a detailed account of the Nevada trust case. About a month after the trial, before Gorman's decision was filed, James and his sister sent Rupert a letter, hoping to reconcile. Thanksgiving and Christmas are upon us, and the three of us wanted to reach out to you personally to say that we miss you and love you, they wrote. We are asking you with love to find a way to put an end to this destructive judicial path so that we can have a chance to heal. As a collaborative and loving family, Rupert wrote back a couple of days later. He had read the children's trial testimony 2 times, only to conclude that I was right. They were unfit to inherit the business. He said he only wanted to speak through lawyers going forward. Much love, Dad. Within a few weeks of the decision, Rupert and Lachlan had filed an appeal. In the end, they settled. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print-impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.